Hello, this is Pearl and Podcast. I'm really happy. Today I'm in Copenhagen and I have invited Anna Louise from the Design Museum to join the podcast. I came here in last August. I went to the museum here. I had a brief conversation with Anna Louise and I think she definitely has to join my podcast. She's one of the most interesting person I've met. So Anna Louise, can you just give a brief about yourself to the audience?
First of all, thank you for your very kind introduction, Pearl, and lovely to have you here. And I'm Anna Louise Sommer. And I'm the director of Design Museum Denmark. I have been here for 13 and a half year, which is quite a long time. And we have been on a journey for these years and a lot of things have happened. I'm sure we're going to dive into that when our conversation starts. And before that, I have a background from academia. I've been at the universities for so many years teaching and researching and also at the Royal Academy of Art. A school of design. So I have a kind of not museum-like background before I came here.
But from being an academia to running a museum, and I was told, and I just read that in 13 years, you actually increased the traffic of this museum. You actually transformed the museum. As an academia, how? How did you do it?
Well, maybe I'm not just the usual academic person, you might say. I've always been interested in other things than traditional academia, though I have a background as a researcher, etc., and professor and, you know, all the stuff. But I've always been very interested in doing things which have a more immediate kind of outcome than being in these long processes you are at the university. I've been very much engaged in leadership and organization development. And I think what might be one of the reasons why we have had some good years here is that I combine all the different things. I mean, governance, leadership, the background within design history and architectural history.
How was the museum like 13 years ago?
Well, it was a very quiet museum, I will say, and I had a lot of considerations before I said yes, thank you to the position. There was about 60,000 visitors, which had been like that for many, many decades. And what I saw when I came here was a wonderful collection with so many potentials. Yes. And a museum which not really opened up to the audience. It was serving a community, you can say, of design and craft aficionados, and I thought there was so much more into it than just this, and the potentials. I was very interested in unlocking the potentials.
So this museum, I think, is really interesting for me, is because I came here, I visited that, and you see the history. From how design is being developed. I remember last time that you were doing some there was videos, there were all different sort of, and you were talking about graphics designer, fashion design. It's all about design in one whole culture.
Yeah.
Was it like that before?
Yes, it was like that as part of the collection, but I will say it wasn't activated as such.
Because there were tons of people visiting your museum non-stop.
I mean, we have actually six doubled the number of visitors. 2024 was the best year ever with 350,000 visitors.
Wow, from 60,000.
Yeah. So
congratulations.
Thank you so much. And what I think we do differently is, well, I had this vision when I came here. I said to myself, I want Design Museum Denmark to be an open and inclusive house for everyone. It should be a place where people would go and would learn and would be enlightened in many ways. And you mentioned just the historical collection, and maybe I should just say that the museum was established in 1890, which means we are almost 140 years old, we are in line with the museum tradition, starting with the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, which is what we in Danish call Kunstindustrimuseum, which is a slightly different word from a Museum of Decorative Art, because it focuses on the industrial part of it instead of the artistic. And saying that, it's also important to say that a lot of the Danish design success, I think, has to do with an artistic foundation and not just being like technological innovations or industry, etc. But the museum goes back to then, and it was established at the time when the industrialization came to Denmark, quite belated compared to other countries in Europe. And it was a wish from different progressive people and interests in society to educate manufacturers, the industry, the craftspeople, the makers, what we would call designers today, and also the educational institutions and the common citizen. So it was a hugely and very, in many ways, idealistic project, educational project. And it had to do with establishing a collection which should be world-class in many ways, not just Danish, but also international. And it should be an educational collection which could be exemplary so that people could learn to appreciate good design, be inspirational.
You know, let's talk about this Danish design. Right? Mm-hmm. I think I learn about Danish design is I mentioned to you, is when I went, first thing, I always thought the Danish design is paradigm, very minimalist, very, you know, is about the forms. Mm-hmm. Everything is about the forms. And then two decades ago, I cannot remember when exactly. I think 2 decades ago, mm-hmm. I went to Design Museum in London and I walked into the Werner Panton exhibition. I was completely flabbergasted. I mean, my God, the colors, just colors and wild, wild, wild. So looking at that, and then I realized, oh my God, this is a Danish designer. I mean, completely the contradiction of a paradigm minimalist design. So after that, I start buying 1960s design books and books and books. So I start learning about Arne Jacobsen. I start learning about the architect. I start learning about that. And then I was inspired, because all of a sudden I realized that 1960s is actually where people was focusing in the Scandinavian design. When they say Scandinavian design, it's actually Danish design in 1960s. But Arne Jacobsen is a big architect here in 1930s.
Yeah, he is.
I mean, and is it because of the lifestyle is changing that people all of a sudden, they look at the Danish design, they look at the paradigm design, but the 1960s was really a celebration of forms. Yeah. And then it happens that it was all about Scandinavian design. Mm. I don't know how the Scandinavian design becomes such a big thing in 1960s. Because 1970s, we talk about Italian design. Mm. Because of laser cut, the machines, exactly. And all that. Mm. But 1960s, why would 1960s that the Scandinavian design become so big?
I think there are many reasons. And you just started by saying that it's very minimalistic, Danish and Scandinavian, very simple, maybe even easy to grasp. But forms. Below that is so many things, and also contradictory things, as you just mentioned by pointing to Werner Panton.
Werner Panton.
But I think that time, as given epoch, might be mature to receive a specific impression of something due to many other factors. And what happens in the late 50s and the 60s was that the Second World War, it lay behind, and we had this kind of very affluent countries, especially in the Western part of the world, and they wanted to do something new. They wanted to have a new beginning, which was political. 2 world wars behind. It was social. It was considering the economic situation, everything. And then they saw these small countries in the north, the Scandinavian countries. They represented a welfare state model, which was unique. They represented
socialist.
Yeah, not socialist, but democratic. It's very important difference, because socialist is something different, but democratic is the essence.
Welfare.
And then in the States, they had some traveling exhibitions in the 50s going on to the 60s. And these exhibitions, they showcased Danish design and Scandinavian design. And suddenly it was like, woo! When in America, North America and in Canada, they saw a completely new world. And if you look at interior design magazines from that time, it was on front page cover, all these things, because they represented something which was, you know, the good quality, the beautiful form, the craftsmanship, nice materials. And maybe you remember, or you can recall, when Kennedy, JF Kennedy and Nixon were running for presidents, mm-hmm. they had one of their last debates. They were actually sitting in the round chair by Wegener. Mm-hmm. And that was a decision from JFK's side. And it was sort of a way to say, I'm part of this young democracy, which is not a young democracy, because in Denmark it goes way back, like in the other Scandinavian countries. So there's also this kind of narrative linking up to the specific design. So but there are many, many reasons for this.
But when I did my research, I realized yeah. that in Hong Kong at that time, apparently buying and Scandinavian furniture is very chic. Yeah. It's luxury,
which is
the opposite yeah. of what Danish design is about. Yeah. Danish design is not about luxurious material at all.
No, but maybe it's, in spite of that, has a sense of luxuriosity yeah. in many ways, because yeah. it is the good materials. It is a beautiful form. A lot of people say that in the, let's call it, the golden age Danish design, there's this kind of, you know, timelessness. And I guess that's the reason why it's still so popular. And yeah. even if you visit Danish homes today, I mean, there's a lot of young designers, they ask, well, what can we do? Because Danish design is about an old chair and we do not have a single place to put our marks. It's all about the legacy. It has changed for the past decades. But, you know, it's something which is, it's timeless, it's durable, it's in that way, it's sustainable also.
Minimalist,
very good quality. And it's not spectacular, but if you look at the details, I mean, if you see a furniture by Finjul or Anne Jacobsen or Wegener, and you look at all the refined details, it's so exquisite in its own understated way, which I think goes very well with the Danish/Scandinavian mentality.
Because if we think about in France,
yeah.
because the French design always influenced the world. When you look at André Putman,
mm-hmm.
André Putman has been using a lot of paradigm design. And I felt that was the core of the business, mm-hmm. is like Danish design or paradigm, because she's generally influenced by Aline Gray. But yeah. when you see all those paradigm, simple design, which leads to minimalist design,
yeah.
I felt the very strong feeling of Danish design.
Yeah, I understand that. I can follow you, definitely. But on the other hand, it's also universal qualities.
Yes.
You can't, as a nation or a country, claim to be minimalistic per se.
No.
It's something we all have access to. And I think
maybe I cannot be minimalist.
No, I have. I can imagine.
I'm a maximalist. Yes, I cannot.
I think I know.
Yeah, because the problem is, because if it is a trend, even if you're not minimalist, you want to decorate as a minimalist. Yeah. I thought this is really not very, not very truthful.
I hope you can follow me anyway.
Yes,
it's not bound to something which is specific for a nation. And for instance, we have been discussing a lot for the past, after all many years, if Denmark is a specific country when it comes to design, and you know, the legacy, the golden age, and all the visitors coming here, because Danish design is like a mega brand globally, see?
Because you do a lot of things. The form is really, yeah, the Danish design is about the form.
And then people, they start to talk about Denmark as being a design nation. And I'm so much opponent to that, because we're not, it's not something exclusively bound to being nation, which is also in the way of reinterpretation, the whole way of thinking nations. So normally I say we are a design society, which means that we can act as a role model, because we have quite a tradition within being a design society, providing design for everyone, accessible, inclusive. I mean, one of the most beautiful things when it comes to Danish design, if you ask me, is that if you go to the years between the two world wars, the 20s yes. and the 30s,
yes.
and you just have a look around. You walk in Copenhagen, in the suburbs, around the country, what do you see? You see high-quality architecture, high-quality design, and it was meant to last. It's still there. I mean, the PH Lamp, the Arne Jacobsen furniture, you just name it, and the... The interesting thing is, it was not the wealthy people's extravagant villas. It was for the public school. It was for the hospital. It was for the dentist's waiting room. It was for, you know, town hall equipment. That means, as I normally say, that everyone in Denmark, born and bred in Denmark, they have grown up with good design. Maybe they have not been a family where you lived in a home which was completely furbished with Danish design, but they have access to it from all the public spaces, also including urban design, etc. And that's something special, because it has to do with investments in good design. And we had some very foresighted political politicians at that time who made it a priority to build the good schools of a lasting quality, instead of having something you do, like 40 years after, oh, we'll just tear everything apart and do something new. So there are so many things you can be inspired by, I think.
In August, last August, I came and especially arranged an architecture and design tour.
Yeah.
So I went and saw Arne Jacobsen.
Yeah.
1930s architecture. I was very impressed because I saw these 1930s building, which Jacobsen designed, but when I went to LA, you know, I love those neutral building, neutral architecture, which is built in 1950s. But when I saw the Jacobsen, they've done it in 1930s.
Yeah.
So my question was to find out whether these neutral buildings is actually basis from the Jacobsen design.
I think what happened with the 20s and the 30s in Europe was there was this huge revolution going on.
Yes.
You can say you have the obvious statements like the Bauhaus, Le Corbusier, etc.
And then Corbusier.
Yeah, everything all over. And we had our take here. Actually, Arne Jacobsen, he had like a two-path profession where he was Le Corbusier on one hand, and he was very much in line with what we call the functional tradition.
Yeah, that's what I wanted.
Yeah. So he was doing both, and he did the functional tradition for...
Can you also explain to the audience what is Danish functionism, which I just learned?
Yes, you know? I will do that as well. So then came Second World War, and a lot of these progressive architects, they went in exile. Arne Jacobsen, he didn't go to the States. He went to Sweden, which was a neutral country at that time. So it was a European tradition coming. So that's why you see neutral and you see the LA situation as it was. So it was really, you know, a kind of melting pot with a lot of different nationalities and inspirations. And Gropius and Mies van der Rohe, they went to the East Coast. And
yes, Mies van der Rohe was in Chicago.
He was in Chicago, and Gropius went to Harvard.
Yeah.
So that means there was all these different kinds of influx all over the world. Then we go to the Art Deco discussion, because that was at the same time. And you just mentioned France, and we know that in France they have this really lavish, exuberant, extraordinary stylistic expression, which has to do with the Art Deco. And it's about luxurious materials. It's exuberant forms. It's just so delicate and so also almost intimidating in its beauty. It's so striking, I will say. And we have it in the States as well.
Very
imagine the Chrysler Building, all the new cinemas, etc. And we have a few examples of Art Deco in Denmark.
Really?
Yeah, but they are very, very few when it comes to design. Actually, Kåre Klint, the father of Danish furniture design, as we normally coin him, he did a few things in 1920, which we would consider Art Deco today. And we have from the pavilion for the Art Décoratif exhibition in Paris in 25. We also have a pavilion having certain Art Deco traits. But it's not Danish to be Art Deco.
It's not Danish, right?
No, because I wouldn't say that Art Deco is showing off, but in some ways it is like quite impulsive and extraordinary. And the mentality of Danes and Danish design is much more this understated. It should be,
show off all the materials,
no,
right?
No, not at all. So
everything is low profile.
Very low profile, very low key, very understated. But it has its own elements, which goes with beautiful shape of forms, exquisite craftsmanship, wonderful materials, but it's plain wood. It's not like including ivory and
ivory parchment
and different kinds of gems and what do I know?
Yeah. Chagrin, the most expensive wood from Africa.
Yeah, no, you wouldn't find it in Denmark.
So what is your comment when someone told me that the reason why Danish design is very paradigm because they come from a peasant culture?
Mm-hmm. It's true.
What's your comment about that? Because you see houses, there's not ornamental. They said, because we come from a peasant culture. Yeah. That is why everything is paradigm and minimalist.
But it is part of it, but it was not just the peasant culture and it was not just Denmark as a rural country, but it is a very important element. And then I will say, if you go back to 19th century, we were not a rich country, but we have this rural background. And it's also if you know a term called vernacular design and architecture, things growing sort of in its own quiet way from the very place, the qualities in the landscape, the country, etc. So there are things which make the Scandinavian countries different from others. But with this idea of a kind of crossroad in the 20s, where you either choose the idealistic, functionalistic path, or you chose the more stylistic. I wouldn't say that Art Deco is just a matter of style, but in some ways,
it is also political language as well.
It is. It is a very political language, but it's also you do a makeover of previously known forms, giving it a like streamline is also part of the Art Deco in line with that. So in Denmark, it was more a matter of, we look at the opportunities we have in design to create this better world. And of course, it has to do with not a socialist background, but a social democratic background, which goes for all the Scandinavian countries.
So Verner Panton, walked into your room of Verner Panton, which is the opposite or the contradiction
of every
Danish aesthetic. When he was working here, mm-hmm. Right. How does people feel that he was using plastic? He's not using wood. He is really a contemporary designer because at the time in the 60s, plastic was the newest material. He's inspired. And how does people feel that? And how did people feel if you're about
Verner Panton? Do you want to hear the truth?
Yeah.
They were terrified. So what could they do? They sort of marginalized him, you can say. They consider him to be an size. What can we do with him within this very fine tradition? Maybe, of course, you know Finn Juhl, and I guess a lot of your audience knows Finn Juhl because he's one of the really great biggest designers.
I visited his house in August.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
But the interesting thing is that Finn Juhl was also the odds number at that time. And he was huge in abroad and many places. But in Denmark, he was too artistic, they said. He was too extravagant because he had this very sculptural furniture and also very expensive. So he was also, for different reasons, marginalized along with the Werner Panton thing. So actually, you had quite a narrow path you can follow when it comes to the good design of the post-war years.
But now they are celebrated.
Now they are celebrated. But and they are not among us anymore, as you know. And I know it was kind of tough for different reasons for both of them. When Finn Juhl, he lived in the 80s, in the 90s. He was not recognized in any ways. There was no interest in his furniture whatsoever. And imagine you have been great around end of 40s, 50s. You've really been praised all over the world. And suddenly you fall into oblivious situation. No one remember you, no one. Wow. And then you have seen what happened for the past two decades.
My God, he is
high rising prices. Everyone is
everybody, things. And his prices, boom,
rocketing.
Yeah.
As a poor museum, we can't be part of that, you know, that race. But at the time, he was not really something. And the same with Werner Panton. He left Denmark. He moved to Switzerland. And he had that as a career platform. And he was much more appreciated there. And one of his...
He's so cool at
that time. And many of his big commissions, they were not in Denmark. They were in Germany or Switzerland or other places in Europe. And that was... I mean,
he's big.
Yeah, I wouldn't say we're narrow-minded in Denmark, but in
judgmental,
some ways,
I think. Very judgmental.
Yes, judgmental and somehow also narrow-minded at some time. You need to follow a certain path, otherwise you'll be the odd one.
You were featured in one of the newspaper recent, I mean, just not recent, today or yesterday, and you talk about design as a soft power.
Yeah.
It's a culture diplomacy.
Yeah.
Diplomacy.
Yeah.
I mean, can you elaborate about the project you did?
Yes.
And it's just being presented.
Yes.
And I think it's really interesting that, you know, because we always say culture is soft power. How would design become a soft power?
Yeah. If I may just put a few words on that one. It was in the Italian newspaper 24 Ora.
Right.
And it was together with the five colleagues from European design museums, from the museum, design museum in Bosch, a design museum in Belgium, in Brussels, and Le Triennale in Milan, and MUDAC in Lausanne, and the Domaine du Bois Boucher in France. And we have been doing a joint exhibition in design museum in Bosch, where you can see it until May. And what we want to do with this exhibition and with the statement published in 24 Ora is that we want to draw attention to the potentials of design museum. What is the role of design museum in a changing world for the moment? How can we be a source of making the world a better place to be? How can we better the understanding of the importance of design in the world? And how do museums have an opportunity, which is quite unique for the moment, to be a platform for, let's say, a critical conversation among citizens? It's important that we as museum also take a stance, and also in a political way, but not in a political way, but in the mode of this soft power or diplomacy. There has been a tendency to underestimate the power of culture in many ways. And maybe the time has come to not to overestimate, but to be open to the potential.
I think it's very important for the audience to understand that. Actually, design, every design of a period of time, it reflects political and about the social condition and also the economic condition, because when we talk about 1960s, we talk about plastic because it was a new material. Everything was round because people going to the moon and because of the invention of the contraceptive pills. Mm-hmm. And then we were just talking about Napoleon invading Egypt. So all of a sudden you have these empire furniture with and Egyptomania. So yeah. This is what you're talking about, is using design to reflect.
To reflect, to understand, and to shape, because you also shape.
Yes, absolutely.
Through your reflections, through putting form, shape to things. So in that respect, I think design is quite powerful.
Design is very powerful because, you know, you have new materials. It really represents the economics situation and the social, absolutely about the society.
And it's not just a question of making beautiful things. No. It's also important to have beautiful things because you need beauty in your life, but it's much more than that.
Yeah. I think, how is your design museum engaged with the international community then?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because in many ways we have these communities, but we are also like islands, being very much the same. We are not having a lot of collaborative exhibitions normally. Sometimes we do take travel exhibitions in. We have also created a few exhibitions together with other museums traveling. So I think we have to differentiate between museums as platforms for exhibitions, which is, of course, a very important thing, being a museum. Differentiate that from being places who systematically collect, reflect through the collections upon the time being, what has been, what will come, and also being platforms for conversations.
Conversations is really important.
Yeah, and conversations could be like, I mean, when we had the opening in Den Bosch, 2 days ago, we had this roundtable panel discussion, the six directors together. And it was actually wonderful to see also how the audience engaged in this discussion. Yes. I really saw the Dutch people as someone very keen, very engaging.
Curious.
Very curious. And I think curiosity is everything. You need to be curious.
Yes, absolutely. Your design museum in Denmark, is this fully funded by government?
No, not at all. We have state subsidizers, which is about 20%.
Only 20%?
20, maybe 25, it depends. But it's
so, and so,
and the rest we generate ourselves.
So you have to raise sponsorship.
Ticketing is the all pervasive thing. We have every single Danish kroner on the front door. And our different activities and our shop.
But I thought this is a social welfare country.
Yeah.
And you're not, getting money from the government?
No.
Oh my God, with all the tax, why are you not getting money from the government?
But we get from the government, but it's still a small part. We have like 6 state museums in Denmark. They are primarily funded by the state, but they still have to generate via sponsorship, private foundations, ticketing, etc. And the rest of us, we are 97 state-recognized museum, as it's called, which means that we are filling some kind of an important role in the complete national museum landscape. Mm-hmm. We have the national responsibility for design, craft, and East Asian art also. And we have main library within our field, a research library and
That's
archives.
Very important.
So when we do things like completely renovation of our historical listed buildings.
You have to raise money.
Yes, that was one of the important things I've been working on for 10 years, and now we just succeeded and completed.
Bravo.
So there's always a lot of projects going on, never a dull moment.
So Anne-Louise, I need to ask you, today, The hottest topic is about AI.
Yeah.
How would AI affect design?
Well,
what's your point of view?
It's a very good question. You know our museum now, and you know that we are not digitally driven in any ways. And that actually goes some years back, where I said to myself, instead of being the last with the first, we want to stick to the analog experience to the experience of authenticity, because a lot of things you can reach digitally via the internet. You can see sit in Shanghai and access Design Museum Denmark's website. But if you are here on the premises, you should really dive into this wonderful experience to see objects where many of them is the only one in the world, because it becomes so grateful that actually museums collect and they exhibit. So that's one thing. When it goes for design mode...
Can AI design?
I think AI might design a lot of things, but we have been discussing not just, you know, ordinary designers. You mentioned Arne Jacobsen, one of a kind, Werner Panton, etc., Finn Yu. You could just mention all of them. I don't think that AI could generate anything like that, but that goes for this state of the art.
How about a designer just draft a style of a furniture, whatever, or a beauty. Then they press the button, the AI does all the construction details.
Yeah, I think you can do combinations. What would be the tipping point for me is if you are Arne Jacobsen, for instance, he hasn't been doing all the drawings of all the wonderful things. He do a sketch and then he hand over to his staff and they do
the construction,
everything. And that part could probably be done by AI. I think so. And especially if you talk about Gen AI and you talk about the coming generations, I think that will happen a lot when it comes to AI in the years to come. For the moment, it's primarily the things already known it can generate, but you know, they are talking about you and I could have an avatar of each of us and this avatar could do things. It knows how you think, it knows how you speak, it knows how you do a lot of things. That will be the future probably. It might change things, but I think for the moment what would be needed and missed in an AI-driven situation is the artistic dimension, the strike of genius, you can say, the unexpected, because all the good designers, not just from Denmark, but all over the world, what makes them unique is they do something which is unpredictable. They grasp the essence of a specific time and they push it further to something which no one could have imagined. And that put them in a position where they are timeless at the same time as very much rooted in their specific time.
Another big question today about design and architecture is sustainability.
Mm.
What is your comment on sustainability?
I think there are many, many, many comments. If I just had one comment,
please.
I will say, take a look at Danish design and look how a chair was made in 1920s. Good quality, exquisite craftsmanship, more or less timeless expression in the shape, and you still use it today. That's sustainability, because it's not use and throw away and new. We all know that the solution when it comes to sustainability is to have fewer things, things of good quality, things will last, and you will use it till the end of their lives, and then it should be recycled in different ways. So that was one take. Another would be, could we dive into new materials, new construction technologies? For instance, it's already basic that things should be possible to separate afterwards, and you should change things, and you should, if a leg of the chair is broken, then you can put on a new leg instead of throwing away the whole chair.
Do you think sustainability is important?
I think it is, but...
But for collection or for people, you know, people always like to change styles, right? So obviously, after a while, they want to change. Sustainability is essential when you keep on changing style.
Yeah, but maybe you could do a combination of having some kind of generic shape or, you know, the basic thing, and then you can change things. It's already there at the market. You have a sofa, for instance. You can very easily change the cushions or set the components in a different order to form another situation. You can I don't know. I think it's very much like this, but maybe it's also a call to action that you do not have to change style.
Yeah. Change is all effect from the outside elements.
It is. Yeah. There's so many components.
Yeah. The last thing I want to ask you. I came here in August and I was very, and I saw the graphics of the blue girl Irma.
Yeah.
And I want to mention again, because I grew up in Hong Kong and it just dawned on me there was this beer. This beer was marketed in Hong Kong, it's in television, it's in everywhere. And I was laughing, I was looking at it. I said, yeah, this is the graphics I've been seeing when I was a little girl. And I saw this Irma, it was a beer. Yeah. It was very funny because it is this graphics that really you remember.
Yeah.
And this was the first time I realized now that it was the first Danish design I ever saw.
Yeah.
And it's such a great pleasure to talk to you, to speak to you.
Thank you so much.
It was great. Thank you.